You're listening to Radio EcoShock on Green 960 AM, San Francisco. Here on Radio EcoShock, we talk a lot about the triple threat. Three main elements that have converged into a joint crisis. You know what I'm talking about. I would say these are the economy, climate, and peak oil. But a listener, an email correspondent from California, prefers these ones. War/empire, the economic crash, and climate along with the environment in general. Those are her big three, and I appreciate being reminded about the role of militarism and world domination in our current crisis. Just consider the hardship to the American image, well, most Westerners, who might not only be losing their own job or home with all the self-image that that represents and the friends that went along with it, and then they learn that their country may no longer be the greatest power of the world. A double hit on identity that has been deeply programmed into each of us. We'll talk about that. We also discussed the personal and psychological cost of hard times, and let's pick up our conversation there. We built ourselves, our guest says, constructed on an identity.
Constructed on an identity and a sense of security that they essentially have never gone through hard times before, whereas other people who've spent their whole lives dealing with hard times may psychologically find it easier to contend with, even though they're actually faced with much more difficult circumstances. So, you know, and I think classically, if you look at, there's a gender aspect to it too, that historically, you know, men were the ones who suffered more on retirement because so much of their social life was organized around work. Of course, since more women have gone into the workforce, we have that as well. But it's interesting to see how, you know, some of the structures of resilience that poor communities have, communities of color, and other people who've been disadvantaged by the economy that was, those structures of resilience may serve us well going forward. And then to continue on to the sort of the empire question or the world power question, it was interesting this fall to watch officialdom, even still under Bush, acknowledge this. I mean, there were some reports saying we're sort of seeing that we're no longer going to be the world dominant power. I don't think the empire is going to give up that easily, but I think there is some recognition that we're undergoing a massive, potentially massive, reorganization of global power. And the whole sense that we've gone from the Cold War world of the U.S. versus the Soviet Union to this moment of triumphalism where it was a unipolar world, supposedly. And now, really, it's not. It's a multipolar world, and the question is, can we live inside that sustainably? Can we find peace? How do we do that? I mean, we have at least three major powers with ambitions for global political and economic hegemony. So I think it's a very open and fluid time.
Well, it seems to me, as a Canadian watching a lot of American media, that the American media has really pumped up this idea, especially during the War of Terror years in the Bush administration, that the U.S. is number one, will always be number one. We had the Project for a New American Century, which seemed to me to say that American military power would establish itself by force, would establish a new empire by force. Well, that's gone by the way, and now we have a new national intelligence estimate that comes out and says, well, in fact, a lot of the wealth has transferred over to Asia, and we expect a multipolar world in which America will play a part. So we are seeing some adjustments being made, but I wonder how difficult that's going to be for the average American who's been fed patriotism in the extreme for so long.
Yeah, I think that is difficult because it feeds into this sort of psychological process we were talking about before with people contending with the economy, that when so many parts of our identities and our sense of security and our sense of who we are and our power in the world, even if we're just identifying in our minds with our national power, for people who are being threatened, you know, economically, if they feel like they're also being threatened in their national identity, I do think that's a lot to bring at someone, and I think that's where we get the danger of right-wing, you know, populism. And because people are so afraid and they feel so assaulted, in the way that their identity has been constructed, that it's a danger we have to deal with. But I also think that the acceptance or non-acceptance of the multipolar world is very much still in play among elites. I think some elites have reconciled themselves to the fact that the United States is one among at least several in the world, but I suspect that there is a significant class of people with global economic power and influence who have not accepted that and are looking to continue the storyline and their sense of the trajectory of history. So I think we have probably a period where we will continue to have a struggle among elites for those who want to sort of accommodate, and, you know, the way Microsoft and Apple had to learn to accommodate to each other because nobody was going to win. And then I think there will be some other elites who will not and will continue to try to dominate the world. And then another question comes for progressives. Is there some way we can exploit those divisions?
Ah, now you're getting into some interesting territory. Now, what would we be aiming at as progressives then?
Well, you know, that's a big question, obviously. I'm not going to answer in terms of a platform of issues. I mean, I think there are lots of good big platforms out there about basic social safety net, basic social justice, and that means both within countries and between countries and between the global north and the global south. But I think strategically and in terms of vision, we need to ask ourselves this question: do we want a solution, for example, to the financial crisis? Meaning, do we want to try to fix the system? Or do we want an alternative to the financial system that we have? Meaning, do we want to replace the system? And I think most progressives around the world are very much ready to replace the system, but I think our elites are still talking about fixing the system. So I do think it's a sort of, in the United States, it's a little bit delicate right now because, you know, you might want to give Obama the benefit of the doubt. A lot of progressives have done that. You might want to give him as much support as you can and build political space for him to, say, fix our healthcare system or provide a green jobs economy. But at the same time, you know, many of us see that the banks are still being bailed out and there's still good reasons to oppose the way it's being done. So I think the political calculus about what sort of reforms to support versus what sort of major radical alternatives to start working toward is not easy. And maybe the answer is we just have to pick some from each side and figure out, you know, what are the holding actions that we absolutely have to have to maintain people in their homes and to prevent people from dying from medical neglect and, you know, really to prevent hunger in this country. And then what can we start building at the same time as alternatives? Because I think we have to seize this moment as a serious, fundamental crisis of legitimacy of everything we've been told was how it had to be, how it was naturally. There is no alternative, you know, and start to articulate our alternatives. It's not so much for me to answer, but I would say there is a global community that has spoken in a diverse way about what that new plan should be. I'm just reading a new report from Global Labor Strategies called Globalization from Below Tackles the Great Recession. And I think that's a great example of a group that's been working with labor and climate together to try to look at what are some alternatives we can work for.
Well, this is the thing. You know, I've just read about Gordon Brown meeting with Obama. He's got a new global grand deal or global grand bargain, they're calling it. And it sounds like the same old people who have been in power for quite a long time wanting to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic, so to speak, and to hold on to those same avenues of power, some of which really haven't worked out, and especially when it comes to the injustice and imbalance, as you talk about, between humans, but also with our climate and environment. And I wanted to just bridge over a little bit. I don't know a lot about this upcoming Copenhagen meeting of climate. I don't really understand what's at stake there, and I'm not sure my listeners have really been that interested, honestly. So can you tell us a little bit about it and what possible hope we could get out of it?
Sure. Well, you know, Copenhagen in December of this year is where the process that brought us the Kyoto Treaty, Kyoto Protocol, is going to negotiate a successor treaty to Kyoto, which officially runs out in 2012. So this process is happening under the UN, under what's called the UN Framework on Climate Change, and Framework Convention on Climate Change, rather. And the concept is basically that the nations of the world come together and agree on a treaty which will commit us to certain amounts of greenhouse gas reduction and other actions, supposedly to address the climate crisis. Now, it's not just an agreement about who's going to reduce how much by when, but that, of course, is the core of it. And the convention is divided into two groups of countries, what are called the Annex I countries, which by and large are the rich countries, and then the Annex II countries, which are by and large the developing countries or the poor countries. So there's an expectation that the Annex I countries will reduce more because we are more responsible for the greenhouse gases that are already there, and that we will reduce earlier because we can. And we have, you know, further to go, so we need to get started sooner. Because it costs money to transform your infrastructure to become a low-carbon economy, there is also a broad expectation that the richer countries will assist the poorer countries in actually making that transition. So this is part of the convention as well, funding and possibly technology transfer to enable the developing countries to do their part in reducing their emissions. And there are a few other aspects, but those are the main aspects of the treaty. In terms of giving us hope, well, I think that a treaty, ultimately what it becomes is a tool that you use to hold your own government accountable. And so I think most people who are working on this politically want to make sure that the treaty that's negotiated is as tough and as ambitious as possible, and also, critically, that it's as fair as possible, meaning that we give, you know, really sufficient commitments of funds to the developing countries, that they can make the transition, that they can afford to do that while still developing and feeding their people. It's pretty much understood that the Global South will not sign a deal that doesn't contain sufficient equity and funding for them to play their part in that way. So many of us see this equity component, this fairness component between the Global North and the Global South as pretty much the linchpin of negotiations, aside from some of the big emitters like the United States and China, sort of making backroom deals before the meeting, which is already, those discussions are well underway.
I wonder, is there any role here for activists? And I've heard some activist scientists are planning on attending and doing something, but is this something that we as the interested public sit back and watch, or is there a way that we can participate or put some pressure to get good results?
Well, first I want to say something about the activist scientists, and then I'll talk about ways for people to participate. The activist scientists are actually getting together well before Copenhagen. They're getting together this month, next week, in Copenhagen, March 10th through 12th. There's going to be an international sort of scientific congress on climate change sponsored by and held at the University of Copenhagen. And it's hoped at this conference that the scientists who attend will sort of give us the official update, which is basically to say the IPCC report was an enormous service to humanity. In many ways, it's an authoritative document, and in many ways, it was very much an understatement, as we've seen with the actual outcomes of both climate science research and the, you know, both the emissions of carbon into the atmosphere, as well as the outcomes in the climate system that have been coming much harder and much faster than was predicted in the IPCC report, as you've covered in your show. So the first thing is to say that, you know, the scientific community is really stepping up in this way, and I hope they have a good media strategy, and I hope they get a lot of coverage. In terms of participating and having an influence on the climate negotiations, You know, there are a couple of ways to do that. Some people are focused on, you know, there's a vast, almost an industry of papers, studies, and proposals that are being created. So the academic community and the NGO community are putting materials on the table to suggest language and suggest programs for how to implement various pieces of the treaty. So for people who are in those communities, there's already sort of a channel for doing that. At the meetings itself, there is a whole role and official place for non-governmental organizations to participate. So that happens already, and that will happen. In terms of people who are not already plugged into those, there's a citizens group on the web for sort of public input about the issue, and it's being sponsored, I think, by the UNFCCC, the Framework Convention folks.
Green 960 AM, Progressive Radio, the heart of San Francisco. If you have just tuned in, this is Alex Smith, mulling over our current crisis, with a Radio EcoShock listener from California as my guest. Back to our chat on the triple crisis. For those of us who aren't willing to wait, you know, 10 years for some new plan to come along, you've also mentioned the idea, and others have been working on this, of course, of transition towns and what we can do in our local communities. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. The transition towns movement, I'm not sure if they were the originators, but I'll tell you who I heard about it from, and that was Rob Hopkins, and he's in the UK, and he lives in a small town called Totnes, T-O-T-N-E-S. And he started, a couple years ago, he started a group called Transition Town Totnes. And they sort of decided, we see this crisis coming, meaning the climate crisis and the peak oil crisis, and we're going to start organizing our town in preparation for this. We're going to figure out how to relocalize our economy. And so, for example, he says in England, where he's working, if you go down the high street, which is the equivalent of our main street, he said, if you look at the records from 100 years ago, you can say, here was where the flour was milled. Here was where the shoes were made. Here was where the local bank was. And a lot of that has gone away, but some of it remains, and the rest potentially could be brought back, especially in smaller towns. There's agricultural land not too far away, and so there's a possibility for a more local food economy. For example, one very practical thing that Rob Hopkins talks about is they're trying to get the city, whenever they plant trees or, you know, other foliage in public places and parks, not to plant ornamental trees, which, as he points out, we've spent a lot of time developing, but rather, why not plant a fruit tree or a nut tree or something that will actually provide food for people as well as all the other features of shade and pleasant appearance. So it's a very pragmatic community-building type of response, which is both economic and social in its nature.
Well, I guess any of us could look that up and try and see if we can get our own town to be a transition town. I've got some websites I'm going to be giving our listeners, including relocalize.net and places like Peak Moment TV and postcarbon.org. All of those places have more on relocalizing. I kind of wanted to get to another point that you raised in an email. You said it may not be enough to organize locally like that, though, if the powers of militarism and manipulation somehow remain in power. Is there something that we have to act to remove? I mean, you said, well, they have a plan and we don't. What are we going to do about that?
Well, I think the simplest and most obvious answer, at least within the United States, is that we have to start talking about the military budget. For some reason, it sort of became undiscussable in the last 10 years or so. I mean, I remember in the 80s and early 90s when we had budget crises and the bases were being closed, and because the Cold War was ending, there was the term peace dividend. And that was, hey, you know, supposedly we've had to spend all this money on nuclear weapons and all these conventional weapons and bases and armies because we've had a you know, imminent threat from the Soviet Union for however many decades, and that's gone, so let's take that money and spend it on jobs, health, housing, education, you know, whatever. Somehow, even though we don't have an imminent military threat aside from the supposed the war on terrorism, which thankfully Obama has abandoned, at least rhetorically, we don't have anywhere near the same kind of military threat. And yet we still have the huge military budget, and, you know, we've had in the United States appropriations on the order of hundreds of billions of dollars on top of the standard Pentagon budget several times a year throughout the entire Iraq war. And, you know, now we have another emergency appropriation for the Afghanistan war. So I think this is where bringing in not only labor and the people responding to the financial crisis, not only peak oil, not only climate change, but really the anti-war movement obviously is centrally related, because we have to go after the Pentagon budget, and that's by far the simplest thing we can do practically. I think we also need to keep our eyes open strategically for the use of climate change as a pretext for intervention. You know, in the last several decades, there have been a number of quote-unquote humanitarian interventions by the United States. And usually, I would say, these quote-unquote interventions have been promoting U.S. geostrategic objectives. There may be a humanitarian side benefit, but in many ways, it could be seen as window dressing towards a geopolitical agenda. There is evidence that some are thinking about climate change in the same way, because it will actually cause substantial dislocation, environmental refugees, drought, you know, hunger. People are going to be on the move. It may cause conflicts. There is already in the 2008 National Intelligence Assessment, which was done on climate, there's some indication that it may be used as a reason for intervening in other countries and continents, and particularly in the African continent. So I think we need to keep our eyes open, and we need to say that even if there's a humanitarian crisis because of climate change, which undoubtedly there will be, it doesn't mean that we have to send in the Marines. We can give money to UN adaptation funds instead. We need to proactively be on this. And it's another reason to support the global equity aspects of the Copenhagen Agreement and support a global fund to transfer money to the developing countries, because we want to solve the problem on the ground before it arrives to the extent that we can, rather than waiting till a crisis occurs and then saying we have to send in the army.
You know, I've seen some, I love to read the comments on a lot of blogs, and some of them are really wild, of course, especially the anonymous ones. But, you know, I saw one where it said, well, you know, if climate really gets out of hand, we may have to bomb the coal producing the electricity plants in China. And I thought to myself, do you realize as you type this that 50% of electricity in America is generated by coal? I mean, if we're going to bomb any plants, let's start at home. And, and we don't want to bomb anything. And that's the last thing that I'd like to get to. And I've seen implications that war is coming. It's just around the bend. In fact, I'll probably have a guest on next week who feels that way. But I just have to feel that there is another whole alternative scenario, which is just as plausible, which is that if things get really bad, the center may fall apart. Mm-hmm. The big militarism may fall apart. We may not be able to pay for all those bases all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so people may be just plain tired of all of that and want to organize in peaceful ways. We may surprise ourselves on, I know it sounds airy-fairy, but some of the goodness that comes out of people in these hard times.
Radio EcoShock at EcoShock.org.